Hi, folks. You're tuning in for This Week in Law. And this week, we've got copyright reform and constitutionality. First monkey pictures, now bird songs. What can you sneak through those TSA backscatter scanners? Lots more. Join us next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 152, recorded March 9, 2012. Second springtime for Hitler. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey folks, it's Denise Howell, and thanks for joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an amazing panel this week, including Adam Dodges from Lifehacker. Hello, Adam. Thanks for joining us today.
Denise. Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So in case you're wondering why we have someone from Lifehacker on the show, of course, Adam does what we do a lot on TWiL, or we try to, and that's give you tips and practical things you can take away to help yourself navigate the rough legal waters of the world. A lot of Adam's posts tend to trend toward the legal problems that you might face. So I'm thrilled to get him on.
Thank you.
Also rejoining us is Stefan Kinsella. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Denise. Glad to be here.
Great to have you once again. Good things to talk about with copyright reform and legislation, trade agreements looming on the horizon. ACT is not alone anymore, so we'll get to that shortly. But first, I want to introduce also Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Great to see you again. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to see you again, and welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. Ought to be a fun time today.
Absolutely. Let's start with one of Adam's wonderful pieces. Recently, he wrote on Lifehacker about how you're breaking the law every day and what you can do about it with a strong copyright emphasis, mostly on what you might be doing as you make your way around the web. Adam, why don't you tell us why you were prompted to write this and give us some takeaways from your piece?
It's actually, I mean, the reason I wanted to write it the most was the idea of tolerated use, and that we have all these copyright laws where so many things are illegal, but a lot of companies tolerate them, you know, such as making a mixtape or just doing a mashup on YouTube, like the Downfall mashup, the Hitler response. And those were taken down for so long by the film company, and people were just so adamant about getting them back because they were so popular that it's become tolerated. And so there are a lot of little things that we've been able to not change, but create kind of an idea of a way that these companies can let us do some things that circumvent copyright law, but we're still actually breaking the law. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much of what we do on the internet every day is actually circumventing or explicitly breaking copyright law. So that was really the motivation for writing the post. In terms of the sorts of things that it covers, things like making mixtapes. I mean, physically actually just making a mixtape in the old-fashioned way where you'd record songs off the radio was illegal, but they couldn't really go after you about that. But now that the internet has provided us a better way of sharing, it's become so much easier for us to get that data out there, but also easier for companies to track what we're doing and come after us for sharing things that they don't want us to be sharing. So there's that, and there are also, I think, a lot of huge problems people neglect to think about in terms of copyright law. When it comes to pirating TV and movies or software, I mean, software can be a really big deal because a lot of the times the copy protection is so difficult to deal with when you have more than one machine or just authorizations in general that you end up really with a system where the people who are actually paying for the software are being punished rather than the people who are pirating it. And so I wanted to get into a lot of those topics and discuss what those problems are, so people are more aware.
Well, I like what you did here, whereas you lay out something that is not okay, clearly against the law, and then you lay out something that may be more in a gray area that's similar, that maybe you can do, but you don't have a whole lot of legal assurance that you're going to be 100% in the clear. And your point seems to be that, you know, we just kind of blunder through our lives not really knowing the guidelines. And you chatted with a law professor.
Yes, I did.
To get some concrete guidelines and insights for your piece. And unfortunately, what you seem to have come away with, I mean, it's not that unfortunate. It's probably a good piece of advice, but it's not very concrete. Is to ask yourself, as you're maybe reusing a photo or somehow obtaining a piece of electronic media to consume, that you should ask yourself, does it feel right or wrong? And just sort of your own moral compass. And you say, while the answer may not always guide you to a fully legal answer, as copyright law currently is comprised of so many gray areas, your own moral compass is often your most reliable guide. And I think, you know, that's really a nice way to conclude. And it's a good piece of advice for people just on a practical basis. What is the status of the Hitler videos at this point? Do you think that they're being removed anymore, or are they just kind of out there and staying?
It's interesting. I actually a friend of mine used to work at Constantine Films, who made Downfall, or I should say produced Downfall. And as I understand it, she told me that they are, I mean, she hasn't worked there for a few years now, but when she left, they were still pursuing takedown notices for all these Hitler Response videos, but there were just too many and they kept being reposted that it was impossible to follow. I think, I mean, they find it to be kind of offensive and don't agree with any of the humor that's in the videos. So it ends up being kind of a thing where I think they either feel overwhelmed or not sure what to do and would gladly take them down if they were able to do so, but it just becomes so overwhelming that it's impossible. So I'm not sure if they're still pursuing it, but my understanding is that they would be if they could.
Stefan, this all kind of goes to a point that you make quite often, that copyright law is irretrievably broken as it stands today, and that we need to do something radical about reforming it. Also, public knowledge has come up with some proposals toward that end, but my take from you is that you don't think they quite go far enough. Is that right?
Yeah. I can understand not advocating total abolition. That's a step that's a little bit too far for a lot of people. But, I mean, the most radical thing they proposed was reducing the current term by 20 years. So the copyright term used to be 14 years, extendable by another 14 years, so 28 years max. And now it's basically over 100. Life of the author plus 70 years. So they want to go from life of the author plus 70 to life of the author plus 50. And that is some improvement, but basically it's very, very incremental and minor. And I'm concerned that it would be actually illegal or a violation of international law because of the Berne Convention. So I mean, there's a reason we changed the law in the 80s to comply with the Berne Convention. So, you know, we're sort of hamstrung by some of these treaties. We would have to find a way to get out of the treaty or have the treaty modified to be able to do that. I did like Adam's post. It was a nice blend of practical and pragmatic guesses and analysis of the law, guidelines, rules of thumb. I actually posted a comment there when I saw it a couple of days ago about there was a study done a couple of years ago that was striking by a law professor, John Tehranian. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. And he did sort of an expansive estimate of the potential liability for copyright infringement of the average net using person, not a Pirate Bay user, but just someone who shares emails and links and pictures. And he gave sort of a narrow interpretation of fair use because it is so ambiguous and hard to apply. So he didn't assume that you had a strong fair use defense except in extreme cases. And he estimated that every citizen who is a net user is potentially liable for $4.5 billion a year in copyright infringement damages.
That's insane.
Now, even if he's off by a factor of 10 or even 100,
yeah,
it's one thing that occurred to me a while back and that I blogged about was that the Bill of Rights, which includes the First Amendment for free speech and due process in the Fifth Amendment and the ban on cruel and unusual punishments and excessive fines in the Eighth Amendment, were all enacted in 1791. Now, the Copyright Clause was 1789, 2 years earlier when the Constitution was ratified. And just by standard statutory and constitutional interpretation, the later ratified amendment supersedes anything earlier that it is inconsistent with. And it seems to me that copyright law, as it is currently enforced and applied, is arguably a violation of the First Amendment, that is free speech, and the Fifth Amendment for due process, and the Eighth Amendment for excessive fines. And therefore, the Copyright Act would arguably be unconstitutional for that reason. This argument has actually been considered and rejected, and the court just sort of hand waves it away and says, well, they were enacted about the same time. But they weren't. They were 2 years apart. And you can repeal a law a couple of years later. And that would be one argument that I think actually could be used, although it would probably be an uphill battle.
Yeah, I've certainly seen instances of the of specific portions, particularly the excessive fines argument asserted against copyright law, but not the entire – the sweeping constitutional argument against the entire act. That would be interesting to have someone undertake. What do you think about that, Evan?
I think it's pretty interesting. I don't know that a successful challenge would necessarily mean that you find the whole copyright clause to be unconstitutional, but certainly – maybe as applied, because it looks like the way that it would go is, because the First Amendment does not expressly repeal the copyright clause of the Constitution. So what I imagine the challenge might look like is that, you know, the copyright or the First Amendment as applied to this particular instance of alleged infringement would, the argument would be that that is abridging the right to free speech, and a court may look to it to see whether the application of the copyright clause and, you know, as empowered or as embodied in the Copyright Act is narrowly tailored to serve a compelling government interest. So it would really be interesting to see the copyright plaintiff in that situation, the content owner, whether that be big media or whether that be just an individual artist, whomever's coming from the pro-copyright standpoint here, to try to argue that there is a compelling government interest in this monopoly in the marketplace. So, hypothetically, I could see where there could actually be a First Amendment challenge along these lines based on the principles that Stefan is talking about in that post and what he's been talking about here today and in the academics who've been talking about this for at least 25 years, to be a real constitutional a First Amendment challenge here that wouldn't necessarily obliterate the copyright clause, but, there could be a really big paring down of it based along these things. So it's radical. It's really crazy to think about and makes a lot of people just naturally uncomfortable. But, you know, what better place to talk about those things than a forum like this and, to kind of do some thought experiments and see where we go.
Well, yep. When I first thought of this argument, I rejected it because it's, too much wishful thinking. I would like copyright to be unconstitutional, but just because you want it to be doesn't mean it is. There's a pretty well-known anarchist writer, Lysander Spooner, from the 1800s, who had this sort of tortured argument that slavery was actually unconstitutional, even in the original Constitution, even though it seems to, condone it and endorse it with some of the language. And I think that's a stretch, although you could argue that, maybe some provisions of the Constitution imply that slavery is unconstitutional, but we did need the 13th Amendment after all. But the copyright argument seems to be one people are sweeping under the rug. I think Eldred just gave like two sentences to it, similar to, in my mind, to the way that the Supreme Court in Texas v. White dealt with the right of the right of states to secede. They basically just said, you know, no. They didn't really give a good reason for it because it was a fait accompli, you know, at that point. But what the courts do, my understanding is, they assume that both the Copyright Clause and the First Amendment are parts of the Constitution, and so then they have to balance them. And I agree with you, Evan, that even if the argument I'm proposing were accepted, it wouldn't mean the Copyright Clause is unconstitutional. It would just any copyright act that was enacted pursuant to it that conflicted with the free speech and the Eighth Amendment, et cetera, would be have to be pared down or something like that. Because the Copyright Clause, you know, maybe there's a constitutional way that's compatible with free speech that you could protect, give exclusive rights to works. Maybe there's no right to get an injunction. Maybe there's no right to criminal penalties. Maybe there's, I don't know, a taxpayer-funded prize system that does the same thing that doesn't chill free speech or whatever. So I do think it's an interesting argument that the opponents of copyright should consider next time they're before the Supreme Court.
Yep, we will definitely look for that and hopefully get some more clarification from the judicial system on it. This is a funny coincidence. You were talking about John Turanian, Stefan, and he was on with us on episode 120 of TWiL. And in that same show, we talked about the reporter who had his camera taken by some monkeys and they took some pictures. They ran the pictures and there were copyright issues about who owned the monkey taken pictures. And Stefan, you had posted something on our Facebook page that reminds me a lot of that, something from Slashdot where someone was making nature videos and there were bird songs playing in the background while he was picking, I believe, lettuce for a salad. And lo and behold, it got flagged by YouTube as something subject to copyright and his videos are being taken down. So apparently someone is asserting that they own the copyrights to bird songs as well as, you know, monkey pictures being, I guess, the precedent for this. What do you think about this, Stefan?
Yeah, I think there was a thread about this on TechDirt, if I recall. And if this is the controversy I'm thinking of, I believe that the company that asserted the DMCA complaint did withdraw it, and then they apologized on the TechDirt comments. But it was sort of half-hearted. Yeah, but they basically have no excuse because you have to, I think, assert under penalty of perjury that you reviewed all this. And so they have all these automatic processes that, you know, no one's giving a lot of thought to. And I think it's a shame. This is part of the problem with having a statutory system of law, especially a statutory scheme like copyright. You know, it's just never going to be thought out in whole. There's always going to be gaps and unintended consequences. And so you have this chilling effect because there's little penalty for us for using the law to make people shut down their videos or whatever. And that would be this was one of the things I was complaining about the public knowledge proposals is, you know, that was one of the things they could have proposed, that we have higher penalties for abuse of the DMCA system. Maybe you have a loser pays system, but only for the losing copyright plaintiff. Not the losing copyright defendant. Even if he loses, he shouldn't have to pay twice because that would just be an even worse, chilling effect. So I think it's sad. And the monkey issue is another example of the gap. I mean, the law certainly didn't contemplate computers or devices creating works back when the Copyright Act was enacted. And I guess they didn't contemplate monkeys doing it either. But technically, there's really no author. So you have these public domain works that are public domain from the moment of creation. It's kind of an interesting thing to contemplate.
Right. Well, I'm sure. I mean, just so we can consider angels dancing on the head of a pin here, I'm sure that there is someone who has gone out, recorded bird songs, and released them in some sort of copyrighted way. And that maybe under those circumstances, they would say that, you know, although these were not my creative act was capturing the wonderful joys of nature. Evan, do you think that there are enough teeth in the DMCA that guard against abuse like this?
Well, there certainly are teeth that are built in. Who knows how? I guess I would say they certainly are sharp, but maybe the best way to stick with the metaphor is that they're located, you know, pretty far back, and it's hard to actually get access to those teeth to try to chomp down on anything.
The molars of the DMCA.
Yeah, because you know, there is a cause of action that somebody can bring for somebody who's been the target of a DMCA takedown notice that was not properly vetted. I mean, there's more of a nuanced way of saying it. But, you know, the real problem is that there's still a pretty high threshold or barrier to entry for aggrieved parties in this situation. So in this, you know, when we're talking about these things and you know, I always get in this mindset, especially talking to Stefan and, you know, considering the really I don't think you would take offense, Stefan, if I called your thoughts on intellectual property, abolitionism, you know, being pretty radical. You know, it always makes me question, you know, like what is the real economic evidence we have to, you know, support any kind of critiques or criticisms of the intellectual property system in general, or, you know, particularly the DMCA, kind of talking to your question here, Denise. I mean, sure, we see isolated incidents. Oh, well, let me just say, we see incidents of DMCA abuses, like the bird songs here. You know, these stories pop up. You know, the whole issue with Linz versus Universal Studios with the Prince song playing in the background. We see from time to time situations of DMCA takedown abuses. But how much does that reflect the larger picture? I mean, are these all of the instances that we're hearing? Are these all the instances of DMCA abuse that are actually occurring? Obviously not. There have to be many more. But how many abuses are there in relation to the overall set of DMCA takedown notices that are issued that are perfectly valid and actually do serve to further the interest of the copyright owner, setting aside the question of whether or not copyright protection should even exist in the first place. But one, you know, these the kind of takedowns that are inarguably valid under the DMCA, the point is, I just don't know. I certainly don't know of enough economic evidence to speak intelligently about whether the DMCA takedown notice system is a good or bad thing. And I don't even know if the evidence is really out there. I'm sure there are plenty of people who have purported to investigate this and get evidence. I'm just leery about making big pronouncements on the strength and virtues of a system when it seems to be so economically based and there's such a dearth of information on it.
So are you guys Repo Man fans? And Adam, are you even old enough to remember this film? No, you're not.
No.
So I think it might have been Emilio Estevez's first big role. And it's something I studied in film class at UCLA. So it's near and dear to my heart. We spent a lot of time with this film. The director, whose name is Alex Cox, was interviewed, and I threw him into our discussion points because he's, you know, representative of the ranks of frustrated artists under the copyright regime. He would like the movie to get more play. You know, there are definitely movies from this era of film that have been re-released on Blu-ray and repackaged, and, you know, it certainly has a cult following of fans. Yeah, best movie ever I'm seeing in IRC. I loved it too. It's fun to watch. Alex Cox is very frustrated. Universal has basically sat on its rights for the film and done nothing with it. So the kicker to his interview is he's encouraging everyone to just go out and pirate the movie because he's not able to have any creative or substantive input into what happens with it now so far down the road. So I guess you have your marching orders there from Alex Cox. What do you think about this, Adam?
I think that it points to something that I've been wondering, I'm actually curious what everyone thinks about this, but it seems that copyright, while very much a monetary issue, is also a really emotional issue for people. And there comes a point, I think, for certain artists will go on the side of saying that this is really that they want to be paid for what they do, that they deserve to be paid for their work. And you definitely see that from the production companies, of course. But you end up with people who come on the other side who are, in the case with this director, who are really very much interested in just getting their work out there. So I think it comes down to an interesting issue where people are really just it's do you feel it's more important to get your work out there and for people to see it and to enjoy it, or do you feel like you don't want your work to be taken and used in ways you don't want? I feel like it comes down to very much a personal decision for the content creator. And that drives copyright law in a significant way, and it's not just entirely monetary.
Yeah, this movie definitely, I think, is a good example of that, because I think it does have meaning to a lot of people. The other great actor who was in it was Harry Dean Stanton, who people most recently might have seen as the head of the big extended family in Big Love, a terrible bad guy in that series on HBO. And here he's, you know, at the very beginning of his career, and he just is spot on wonderful. And so I could see where Alex Cox would be frustrated to have captured, you know, this great kooky story and wonderful performances and not have subsequent control over what happens with his film. Any thoughts on this, Stefan?
Yeah. Well, first of all, he apparently doesn't have the rights anymore, so he should watch out. He may be sued or put in jail for inducing copyright infringement, for contributory copyright infringement. Let me give what's happened here is the person who created the movie has no rights to authorize others to use it. He has no rights to give permission for people to show it here or sell it here like he wants. And he can't even make a sequel, right? If he wanted to make a sequel, he doesn't even have the derivative rights. One way to think about this, in my view, is think back about how copyright arose. It arose out of the system of state and church control in the 1400s, 1500s of what books could be printed. So there was a stationer's company that had the monopoly for a good 100-something years. And so authors, their books would only be published if the stationer's company, which was controlled by the state, basically, would permit their book to be published if it wasn't dangerous or heretical or, you know, whatever. When the stationer's company monopoly expired, the publishers were used to this, and they asked Parliament to extend it. But what the Parliament did was, in the Statute of Anne in 1709, instead of granting this new copyright back to the printers, they granted it to the authors. And something similar happened, I believe, in France and in Europe around the same time. And the reason the authors liked it was it basically freed their works partially from state censorship. In other words, instead of someone else having the right to decide whether this book could be published, the author had the right. They really didn't want to have a right to stop others from publishing it and to go around suing people and acting like little monopolists themselves. They basically were just basically taking some control back away from the state. But what's happened was this model has evolved into yet another model similar to the original system that copyright replaced, where you have these big oligopolistic gatekeepers like the Hollywood industry, the music industry, and up until recently, the creators basically had no choice but to sign away their rights to these companies in order to get published or to make a movie. And so you have the same situation now as you had back in the days of the stationer's company. And in the music industry, at least, this is being undermined a little bit with the internet and in the book publishing industry as well. So I think you're going to see just technology is going to help override the gatekeeper role of the publishers and the music companies that that copyright has helped to prop up these last 200 years.
All right, Evan, any thoughts before we move on?
No, other than just, I mean, this is a great example of the, you know, underscoring the ways in which the ownership of creative works and creative people are seemingly and wrongfully taken by big copyright interests like this. That, of course, is offset by the sentiment I get every time I actually, you know, make a donation to big media by buying movie tickets and seeing how awesome some movies are and realize that it would be very difficult to make those things if there weren't a robust system of exclusive rights given to the movie studios in those situations. Like, we just went and saw The Lorax this past weekend, and, you know, it's like some really amazing stuff that goes on in modern day Hollywood. So it's really hard to talk about these things. Or it's really hard for me to talk about these things in absolute terms because I see the unfortunate human side on the creative side, but also there's some pretty awesome stuff going on the creative side, which is brought about, I think, because of the exclusive interest that big content has.
All right, so we'll close out our discussion with just leaving you with Bud's repo code from Repo Man. I shall not cause harm to any vehicle, nor the personal contents thereof, nor through any inaction let that vehicle or the personal contents thereof come to harm. There we go, following his moral compass, along with Adam's advice from his piece. We're here today with Adam Datches from Lifehacker and Stefan Kinsella and Evan Brown, and having a great discussion about primarily copyright law so far, but I want to get into the TSA and the TPP pretty soon. First, I want to thank, though, our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. That iPad app is getting better and better. I'm telling you, it comes in so handy. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. And if you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. They're inexpensive and easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and finish it on another in a completely different geographic location, which, again, comes in incredibly handy as we go about our day around here. However you decide to use Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So get on out there. Try it for 30 days, absolutely free. Do that by going to netflix.com/twit. When you use that URL, it lets them know we sent you, which we greatly appreciate. And we greatly appreciate the support of Netflix for This Week in Tech and This Week in Law. Thanks so much, Netflix. All right. So anybody who's been wondering about those TSA backscatter X-ray scanners and how effective they are, there's a blogger out there. I'm not real clear on what this person's name is. He has a blog called TSA Out of Our Pants and tweets at TSA Out Our Pants. And he's gone ahead and done a video demonstration of the ineffectiveness of the backscatter scanners. Now, the notion of those scanners is that when you stand with your arms out, you know, you've all seen the pictures. It's pretty graphic that you get this white silhouetted person's body absent their clothes. And if they're holding a gun against, you know, their chest, it shows up against that white background. So brilliantly enough, this guy decided, well, it's that black on white background thing that's making these things work, right? So what if I just sewed myself a little pocket right on my side where the backscatter scanner is going to show a dark object against the dark background that's behind the person's body. And so he put this to the test. He slipped some stuff in his pocket. I think we might have the video of that ready, perhaps, maybe. Can we show that?
know how much danger the American Transportation Security Administration is putting us all in with their haste to deploy the expensive, invasive nude body scanner program. When the machines came out, we were told that the invasion of our privacy, doses of radiation, and trashing of our constitution were necessary because the old metal detectors weren't good enough, that non-metallic explosives were a threat, even though no one has boarded a plane in the U.S. with any type of explosive in nearly 40 years.
Colin, if you skip up to about 120.
Devices, Rafi Sellers, there's the background, and therefore completely invisible to both visual and automated inspection. It can't possibly be that easy to beat the TSA's billion-dollar fleet of nude body scanners, right? TSA can't be that stupid, can they? Unfortunately, they can and they are. To put it to the test, I bought a sewing kit from the dollar store, broke out my 8th grade home ec skills, and sewed a pocket directly on the side of a shirt. Then I took a random metallic object, in this case, a heavy metal carrying case that would easily alarm any of the old metal detectors, and I walked through a backscatter x-ray at Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. On video, of course. While I'm not about to win any videography awards for my hidden camera footage, you can watch as I walk through the security line with the metal object in my new side pocket. My camera gets placed on the conveyor belt and goes through its own x-ray, and when it comes out, I'm through, and the object never left my pocket. Maybe just a fluke. Okay, let's try again at Cleveland Hopkins.
So he does it again, and I think we get the idea. You know, he's basically hacked these multi-million dollar scanners with a sewing kit and a little pocket. this definitely seems disturbing. You know, so many people are alarmed by the medical perhaps impact of these scanners and just the fact that they're so invasive, and the pictures that they take of us all are really kind of awful. I mean, nobody looks good in these scanners, I think. I just saw the Alvin Ailey Dance Company yesterday. Maybe those guys look good, but none of the rest of us do. So, Evan, what do you think about this? He says he's supplied the TSA with his video. Do you expect this to have any impact?
Yeah, of course he supplied the TSA to this video. He supplied it to all of us. So I'm not sure what's so wonderful about that. I mean, he's got an agenda here. He's a plaintiff in a lawsuit. He's sued the government for violation of his Fourth Amendment rights here. So this is, you know, a public service on steroids. He's got his own personal agenda to get this information out there and discredit the TSA. But, you know, I'm saying that and I'm not necessarily either explicitly or implicitly saying that the TSA doesn't deserve to be discredited in all of this, because you know, you read some really smart people talking about the TSA and its procedures and how ineffective it is, and how really what it does is provide the contours for Al-Qaeda telling them what not to do and what, you know, what not to try to do if you're going to try to bring something onto to an airplane. And so you know, my personal view on all this is that you know, the TSA is overreaching. It's got its own political perspective on all of this, and it has to do everything it can to reassert its relevancy, and so it's overdoing it a lot just so that it looks more important than what it is. You know, I would be leery of you know, doing away with the TSA, because I think there certainly needs to be some kind of layer of protection there at the security gate level. My impression is that most of the good law enforcement efforts and counterterrorism efforts are done, you know, well away from the airport security gate, and so that leads one to, you know, it leads one to consider that they should be kind of skeptical, or at least, you know, thinking a little bit when you hear these statistics that nobody has ever boarded a plane without an explosive, or, you know, with an explosive in the last 40 years. It's what this kid, Jonathan Corbett, you know, who did that video, he said. I mean, yeah, that could be a good thing. That could be something that, you know, that security layer has been responsible for. It's also, you know, the responsibility of counterterrorism and law enforcement efforts far away from that. So the bullet points from what I've just said: the TSA does overreach. It deserves to be discredited. But, you know, videos like this, you know, let's take them for what they're worth. They're useful, but let's not drink the Kool-Aid necessarily.
Adam, you getting ready a story how to sneak through the backscatter scanners with your sewn-on pocket?
I probably should. I've written a lot about the TSA and some of their policies, and sometimes they're reasonable, but for the most part, I feel like it's a lot of security theater, and they're really just Best Buy greeters who check your bag at when you leave with a with some fancy gadgets. I personally don't mind the ugly pictures. I don't think that's that big of a deal. They're not being saved, hopefully. And they say they're not. I think the problems go in more with the health issues and the fact that they're wasting money to put in these fancy machines. It's just kind of disturbing when they can be hacked this easily. I do think that the video does point to a significant problem in that. We obviously need security at the airports, and I do think security theater does have its place because it tells people that somebody's watching, and that there's a possibility of you getting caught if you go in and you try to sneak a gun or whatever on the plane. But if it's that simple to do, if he's able to actually make that happen, I would hope that would encourage the TSA to actually think about what they're doing, although it seems that doesn't seem to be a thing they do too often, and maybe come up with some security theater that actually has a more practical use and can actually detect things. There's certainly been a lot of suggestions. It just seems like they're never being taken.
Yeah, Virgil in IRC thinks they should have tried this at the airport in Israel. Assuming they use backscatter scanners there and assuming that would have been in anybody's budget, though he must have been flying somewhere, right? To get through security, you have to actually have a boarding pass on you. Stefan, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, a few. I think I read recently that Israel explicitly rejected this technology in favor of their other techniques. I could be wrong about that. And as much as I agree with the Corbett's agenda, I think Mike Masnick had a post yesterday on TechDirt, and Mike Masnick is skeptical of the TSA's efficacy as well. I mean, they did let the guy's items get through, but I think that according to Masnick, and he seemed to have a believable post, this guy's claims about the way the machines work are outdated. This is old news, and they do work differently now. Mm. And probably they surround you and they go around you. So Masnick has a post on this yesterday, sort of updating a lot of the information on this. But what was interesting, on Slashdot, there was a post yesterday called TSA Warning Media about reporting on the body scanner failures. So one reporter claims that they got a kind of subtle warning from the TSA, maybe you shouldn't be covering this Corbett thing. So it looked like they were trying to stop the story from spreading. But the one thing I thought was interesting was on the TSA's own blog, it's blog.tsa.gov, there's a response to this from the TSA. And there's just one line in there, which I was a little shocked by. They're basically defending their technology and their practices, and they're explaining why, you know, we need to be able to detect things as large as a gun or non-metallic weapons or tiny pills and bags of drugs, which, of course, you know, people smuggling drugs on airplanes is not a safety issue at all. But what this blog post says, and I believe this is an official TSA post, says it's one of the best tools available to detect metallic and non-metallic items such as ... you know, things that go boom, all capitals. And I'm thinking you don't want to be reading the TSA's blog out loud at the airport or even reading it. If you have it open on your iPad, you may be in trouble. Don't
That's
talk
funny.
About boom at the airport.
Yeah, they're clearly trying to reach out to the common person with that. I thought it was pretty interesting. Hopefully they have managed to deal with the problem, and I'll go check out Mike's post, which I have not seen. It's disturbing that they wouldn't be able to get that side angle in there, and it seems like something that should have come up before. So hopefully it has, and they've addressed this. So let's talk next about net neutrality, since we haven't talked about that in a while. There is a threat out there to the FCC's watered down net neutrality rules, which were enacted a while ago now. It was subject to a legal challenge, and Metro PCS and Verizon have been seeking permission to go forward against the FCC and challenge those rules. And this week, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals has decided that, yes, indeed, they can have that suit, and it will be pending before the same court that decided the FCC, you know, adversely ruled against the FCC in its decision about Comcast and throttling. It'll be interesting to see that unfold. And there's a scathing post by Stacey Higginbotham over at GigaHome where she basically sums it up in the most pessimistic way possible. That means the FCC would turn from a letter-writing gadfly occasionally stepping in on behalf of consumers to a powerless relic of an agency as the web becomes more central to our lives. So we'll definitely watch that case. Evan, are you surprised at all that they've gotten permission to go ahead and try and eviscerate the FCC's net neutrality rules?
I guess I'm not surprised. And, you know, but while I don't, you know, necessarily back the hyperbole of saying that the FCC is going to become irrelevant in all of this, it does seem like there could be some pretty drastic consequences of a decision that doesn't come down on the FCC's side here, because it's been so tenuous as to what the FCC's role is in all of this. So even if the decision is in favor of the providers here who are trying to challenge all of this, the scheme here, that wouldn't mean that the network neutrality debate is over. There would still be other ways, legislative means. Maybe this would preclude any meaningful regulatory means right at this point. But you know, it's this seems to be the natural thing that should be happening next in the dispute. So it'll be interesting to see where it comes out.
Do you want to give any speculation as to where you think it might comes out, Stefan?
Well, it looks to me like they don't have the legislative authority to enact these kind of regulations. They're trying to cram it under this ancillary jurisdiction that was shut down, and they redid it. I'm just not sure. As a libertarian, I always focus on the big problem, which is the state. And I actually don't understand, as a technology person, what really is so wrong with tiered services and charging per use and just letting the free market operate. I'm actually opposed to the government coming in and saving us from companies charging us for a service. The free market should sort that out, with one caveat, and that is I do believe the market we have is heavily distorted because of the state intervention and regulations over all these years. I mean, you have basically larger companies, more oligopolized industries because of a variety of effects of government regulations in the first place. So it could be that in a freer market where the government hadn't intervened in the first place, you wouldn't have as many big companies with as much market power to do what some people believe is unreasonable. You would have a larger number of smaller players, that you'd have more grainy sort of competition. But I don't think the solution would be to give the federal agencies even more power, or at least not without it being constitutionally based and having a legislative base.
How about you, Adam? Are you fearful that we're going to go toward tiered internet for all of our consumption rather than just as far as AT&T and its unlimited users, quote unquote?
Yeah, I mean, that is, it's definitely a fear that comes up when you're writing for a blog and there's this very distinct possibility of being part of a package that you're not really in control of from some service provider that you don't really deal with. And so The idea of a non-neutral internet kind of scares me a lot. But I also am hesitant to come down on the side of regulation as well, because I feel like that's still just one organization making a decision for everybody on what should and should not happen. And that I'm trying to think of a safe way to say this, a believer in the effectiveness of disobedience. I think that with all the opposition that's currently there for a tiered service kind of internet, I think that people will fight back. I mean, we saw that with PIPA and SOPA. That was, I thought, a really beautiful thing, and how the internet came together to fight those bills. And I think that if we end up with a non-neutral internet, that will happen as well. So I'm scared. I'm also a little bit hopeful that if things do not go the way that I personally would hope, everyone will kind of band together and take it on.
You see, that's what's so ironic or paradoxical or counterintuitive or whatever about the network neutrality issue is that SOPA and PIPA, the whole kind of sensibility underlying the opposition to those things is that we don't want the government all up in our business and giving these rights to content owners to be able to do more, you know, in terms of regulation. We don't want there to be more detail as to what these rights are that are spelled out. But with network neutrality, if there was the same kind of uproar that you're talking about, Adam, and I'm not saying that, you know, it's you're ill-advised or misguided or anything, all this stuff, what the uproar would be an uproar against the lack of the government being all up in the business of the providers, of the network providers here. So I see that's a really interesting contrast where, you know, at one time, and I guess I'm just saying this, you know, again, because Stefan's in the conversation with us, I wouldn't be thinking this much like a libertarian if it weren't for that, you know, influence coming through the wires. You know, I mean, it's just weird that in one instance, people want the government to back off and not give more power. And then the other instance to say, government, come and help us make sure that we have, you know, these rights. It just seems weird that you would be disobedient to whom because the government's not helping you. It's just kind of, it's kind of weird.
Well, I think that the disobedience doesn't necessarily have to apply to asking for regulation. And when we don't like something, when we complain about a certain problem, it's not necessary. We're not necessarily always going to the government. When Bank of America wanted to charge that $5 fee for using a debit card, people complained for months and were relentless about it, and they backed off. And so my hope would be that actually the disobedience would affect the companies and they would realize that it's not necessarily the best business decision because the internet has become what it is because of the freedom that people have to do what they want to do on it.
So it sounds like market forces, the same thing that Stefan is saying. So
right,
then we don't need the
forces,
government.
Market forces have to have some degree of chance of succeeding, right? When I'm sure people aren't happy about all the charges and expense of their cable bills, but their only recourse is to jump to satellite, which is just as expensive and fee laden. You know, there's no real way for them to protest there. You know, they can cut the cord and only consume things like our show here. I think that more and more that is happening. But, you know, Corey, whether that's really going to have a huge impact for a long, long time, I think, you know, maybe the question is there a government role that helps balance the relative bargaining positions of the parties? And, you know, I'd like to think that there would be that kind of role, but we'll have to see what the court thinks about that. Lou in IRC says, there needs to be some regulation. Otherwise, we have Comcast deciding that Google shouldn't be my search engine or that I shouldn't be allowed to access Twit. So I think that's basically the same point. Let's talk about things that people might decide to get protesty about. ACTA, of course, is still coming down the pike. And we'll hat tip Mike Masnick again. He has a good post about the latest on that front, that there has been a confirmation that the State Department is admitting that ACTA would be binding on the United States, not something that we could just opt in or opt out of. And that sort of juxtaposes against the fact the administration is saying we can opt in or opt out of it without congressional approval. So that little nuance on the ACTA front occurred this week. What do you think about this, Stefan?
This is an example we were just talking about, getting the government to protect us. And this is the same government that right now is trying to sneak in these draconian treaties that might help kill the internet. So you know, when I hear I'm from the government, I'm here to help you, I get a little bit nervous. Adam was talking about how the internet heroically rose up and at least temporarily stopped SOPA and PIPA, but a month or two before, Obama signed the ACTA without any protest, and now they're marching forward with the TPP. The ACTA situation is interesting under international law. My understanding, going back to some of the courses I took, my understanding is that if ACTA is potentially binding under international law, which simply means that if the United States did not comply with it, which we already do apparently, but let's say we modified copyright law so that it was no longer compliant with ACTA, we have the perfect right to do that. We have legislative sovereignty. It's just that we would be technically in breach of international law. And I don't think it's a treaty under the constitutional sense, so it's not the law of the land. It's not the supreme law of the land. It's just it gives the United States an international obligation that it's in breach of. Still, it's got troubling consequences. And I completely agree with the calls that the negotiations for TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let me ask you first, before we go further, does anybody know what's in the TPP? Has there been a leak along the lines of what happened with ACTA, or is it still completely under wraps?
Not that I know of.
I haven't seen the text, but I've heard reports that it has DMCA-type provisions, which is trying to impose on some Asian countries. Although my understanding is that there's a TechDirt post, I think today, arguing that there's an extremely low chance that China will ever sign on to ACTA or TPP, which mm-hmm. would largely gut their effectiveness, but they're still troubling.
It would gut their ability to counterfeit? Is that it?
No, if China doesn't sign on to ACTA and TPP, they're one of the major counterfeiting countries. So the acts wouldn't have much effectiveness at stopping counterfeiting.
Oh, I thought you were saying that they found some kind of sense of morality and didn't want to sign this because then it would be illegal to counterfeit. That's why I was getting wrong. Sorry.
Following their moral compass. Yes. All right. So we have TPP out there being negotiated. Nobody knows what's in it. Public Knowledge has a good post about how it's secret, and we don't know what's in it, but we're troubled that it's secret. There's really nothing more to do about that except for, continue to talk about it and know that it's out there. Any thoughts on this, Adam?
You know, I don't know a whole lot about TPP. Well, it sounds like no one really knows a whole lot about it.
Right.
So I really don't have too many thoughts about it. I've been recently reading up on ACTA, which kind of scares me quite a bit, just in terms of how capable it is to shut people's internet off. I don't like the idea at all of further provisions being made without anyone really having any say in it. In terms of the public knowing and the public being able to speak about it. We don't, just some means of us being aware of it would definitely be nice.
Right. Well, over in the UK, it's no secret that the Digital Economy Act has gone into effect as of this week. There had been a court challenge to it. This is an act that would allow ISPs to deny web users internet access if they were suspected of file sharing. It's been knocking around as a proposal there, but it has been challenged. And this week, the challenge was thrown out. So it is the law in the UK, and BT and TalkTalk will now have to work with media companies to decide, whether their users are using the services to infringe or not. So this is the kind of thing that can happen if people aren't super active and aware and telling their legislators that they don't want to be governed this way. Evan, does this scare you at all as something that could come into play in the U.S., or do you think it wouldn't be that big a deal?
Well, it'd be a huge deal if it happened. I guess I wish I had a better understanding of how it works in Europe, because, there seems to be you know, you got this Digital Economy Act, but then you got the stuff going on with the European Court of Justice, which seems mm-hmm. to, you know, with the EU level, things seems to be a little bit more sensible here. So, I mean, the most I can extract from this as far as meaning is, you know, the graduated response, you know, kicking people off the internet without, you know, full kind of due process or quasi due process kind of thing is not a good thing. So that's why I, you know, would vote thumbs down on this. But, you know, I confess that I don't have as rich of an understanding as I would like to or probably should have.
Right. I'm just bringing it up because it has been knocking around out there and now it's going to actually become law in England. One thing I'd like to close out the show with here as far as our stories go, Evan, you posted that I thought was really interesting, and that is that Facebook has come so far as a communications medium that a judge would actually impose a penalty on a litigant. Here it's a couple going through a divorce and a husband that was under some kind of restraining order for making threatening statements or any kind of threatening action toward his former spouse. And he posted something on his Facebook page that sounded like it wasn't a direct comment to his spouse. Let's see if I can get the exact verbiage here. If you are an evil, vindictive woman who wants to ruin your husband's life and take your son's father away from him completely, all you need to do is say that you're scared of your husband or domestic partner and they'll take him away. So he's making sort of an anguished statement that he's not directing straight at his wife, but the court had found that violated the order he was under. So the penalty the judge imposed was that he must now publish on his Facebook page. And you can check it out on his Facebook page. His name is Mark Byron. So he's publicly apologizing now under court order for having said this thing previously on Facebook. So the ramifications here are pretty varied, that Facebook could be, you know, part of what a court would order, that you take some action on Facebook, and also, of course, that the guy's freedom to post what he wants on Facebook is definitely brought into question by this. Evan, what were you thinking when you first saw this?
I think it's less a testament to how pervasive Facebook has come in our lives and more a testament on the extent to which this judge was just completely ignorant of the First Amendment. I mean, the judge just mm-hmm. got it completely wrong. There's nothing around that. This was the wrong ruling. This is unconstitutional. It's a severe violation of his rights. And if there's anything we should be all up in arms about, it's that this guy's constitutional rights are being completely trounced upon. You know, even if it was in violation of an order, the remedy for the violation of that order should not be compelled speech. So we got to look at, you know, this whole narrow tailoring analysis. I was alluding to it earlier. If it's is there a compelling government interest that's served by having this guy speak? And is it narrowly tailored? Is having him speak the narrowly tailored remedy to meet that compelling interest here? And no, he could have just been subject to an order to say stop doing that, or maybe a fine or something like that. I don't know. But forcing him to speak like this is just wrong. It's unconstitutional. There's no way around it. This was the wrong decision by the court.
Yep. Anybody else think otherwise? Stefan,
no,
what
I
do
agree.
You
think?
Yeah.
I think it's bad enough that the state can impose penalties and damages and put people in jail, but then to force them to say something they don't actually agree with, it just seems monstrous. I mean, it's like convicting someone of a crime, and let's say they're actually innocent, but they get convicted, and then the court orders them, and now you have to go tell people you're guilty. You can't even disagree with me. At least right. Let people complain if they don't agree with the system. But I would actually disagree with one thing Evan said, and that is I'm an extreme federalist, and I'm actually one of the people who doesn't believe the Bill of Rights applies to the states. So I think this was a state case, so I would say it violates probably the state's constitutional provisions, but not the federal. Although I wouldn't begrudge the guy from trying this if he had to assert the Bill of Rights, yeah. And I would hope he would win. But still, legally, I think there's a problem with asserting the Bill of Rights against the states.
Right. Adam, another life hacker post. You know, don't trash your ex on Facebook, of course. It's probably good common sense, but I do think this is an interesting twist that that the guy could be compelled to take action on Facebook as some kind of remedy. I suppose it makes some kind of sense if the judge, you know, leaving the speech problems aside, if you're going to try and fix something, what happens on Facebook stays on Facebook, I guess. You know, if you're trying to fix something that happened there, that you use that medium to do it. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
No, I'm not in a legal context. I mean, what I think if I would make a comparison to it, it seems like something that would happen in the Middle Ages, in which you're being punished by the king to go out into the town square and apologize publicly to everybody. It strikes me as a misunderstanding of technology and what Facebook really is. And what he said also, it was not even direct. So it seems weird to me that he's apologizing directly for something that he said was as a kind of implied statement. So right. I just seems very wrong to me, and a very strange abuse of Facebook and just technology in general. I mean, the law forcing someone to do that just seems completely ridiculous to me.
Yep, very strange. All right, well, we're going to move on to our resource of the week and tip of the week. Of course, we already mentioned Adam's great article, How You're Breaking the Law Every Day and What You Can Do About It. So if you have not yet checked that out, please do. We're going to give you one more resource, which is 15 Copyright Rules Every Student Should Know. This is from onlinecolleges.net. And it's a good set of premises for folks who are not lawyers. And, you know, it's aimed squarely at college students, but it really is a great resource for anybody who's not legally trained. I'm certainly, you know, hopeful that kids even younger than college would get a lot out of this just to understand how fair use works and how copyright works. It's a nice little primer on copyright law, and it's taken to a practical level, things you can and cannot do. So I like that a lot, and I like onlinecolleges.net for putting it out there. And then, Evan, you had a great practical thing. Again, you know, talking about the role of social media in our life and how more widespread it has become, how one would properly cite a tweet. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm pulling up the link now. I forget who it was, what organization it was that published this. But yeah, it was the Modern Language Association. I don't know anything about them, but with a name like that, you can't argue with what they say. You know, it's this formal way to cite a tweet. And for those of us who are watching on video, you can see it on the screen now. There's this format here that has, you start off with the real name, the real last name, then the first name of the Twitter user, and then in parentheses, the Twitter user handle, and then put the tweet language itself in quotes, and then the time, the date and time. And then, you know, it's kind of, it's a nice little double entendre at the end of the citation. You just put the word tweet, period, as if just, I don't know if that's to designate that it's a tweet or if you're just saying, you know, tweet. Carol, you don't want to record any bird sounds from nature to invoke that. That's because that's a copyright issue. But
that's right.
Oh, you know, sure, it's cute. You know, we, you know, it's you know, something that is indicative of you know, the power that this form of social media can have. And if anybody can say something that's, you know, important enough to be quoted in a scholarly article in 140 characters, then that person is an uber academic and way to go. There's a framework for them to reside in now, a formal one.
Sure. And I presume, I don't know if the Blue Book, which is our guideline as lawyers, has any sort of parallel rule, but I assume this one would work by default in the absence. So nice. Thanks for that, Evan. And we'll get out there and start citing away. With that, guys, I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up. Thank you so much for joining us today on This Week in Law. Adam, it's been great meeting you.
Great meeting you too. Thanks.
You can, of course, check out Adam's posts at lifehacker.com, and you are a Duchess on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we've loved having you on, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Stefan, great to have you back on too.
It was fun. Pleasure.
And thanks for all, if we didn't get to all the great stuff you posted on the Facebook page, but people should definitely go check it out at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. We could have done a whole show just on the stories you posted there. So we'll have to have you back on and pick those threads up. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And Evan, great to see you as always.
Well, thanks, Denise. It was great to talk with you. And Adam, really nice to meet you. Enjoyed being able to talk with you after reading your stuff. And Stefan, always great to talk with you. You're such a smart guy, and you're not afraid to just come out and say it. So I really appreciate, you know, the conversations we can have about these things. You're doing some interesting stuff. So I've enjoyed our talk today.
Thanks. Me too, Evan.
Right on.
Great. And I forgot to mention, you should definitely follow Stefan too on Twitter. He's at Ennis Kinsella. Evan is at Internet Cases. And they're out and about on the web in various other places too. Really smart folks that if you have questions or want to further pursue the threads that we've talked about today, check out their own websites and blogs and you'll get much, much more. And for more Twill, of course, you should join us on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time. And that's when we record live at twit.tv. You can find the show after that in iTunes and on YouTube, various other places where we distribute the show, and of course at twit.tv as well. I love to hear from you between the shows, either at our Facebook page, which I mentioned, or over on Google+. There's a page. You can email me directly. I'm denise@twit.tv. We get great stories from you all and try and use them whenever we can. So keep them coming. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Law the next time. Thanks a lot, everyone, for being here. Bye-bye.